William and the Waxwork Prince. It was William who heard that a fair was breaking its journey across country and setting up for one afternoon only, just outside the village.
"It's going to be a jolly fine one," said William. "There's going to be a waxworks and all sorts of things."
The outlaws loved fairs, but a waxworks was something new. The only problem was that it was a school day, and the fair would be moving on only an hour or so after school finished.
"Any decent school," said William bitterly, "would give a half holiday the day a fair's coming."
"'Stead of which," said Ginger gloomily, "I bet someone keeps us in just because they know we want to go to it."
"We'll go straight off the minute school's over," said William. "As soon as the bell rings, we'll run to the fairground and stay there till they start packing up."
The day of the fair was fine, and the outlaws felt that fate was on their side. All went well at school until the last possible moment. As William was about to leave his form room, Hubert Lane, the sworn lifelong enemy of William and the outlaws, was passing the open door, walking, as it happened, just ahead of the headmaster, Mr. Markson, old Marky. Hubert Lane met William's eye and, in the comfortable knowledge that the headmaster could not see him, contorted his pale, fat face into a grimace of ridicule and defiance that William found intolerable. William seized the nearest weapon to hand, which happened to be his school satchel, and hurled it. It missed Hubert, but caught the headmaster very neatly.
"Did you throw that, Brown?"
William, thinking that he might as well go down with colours flying, assumed a debonair expression and said,
"Yes, sir."
"Stay in an hour after school,"
said Mr. Markson, and passed on his majestic way, growling. The horror of the outlaws was indescribable. But there was nothing to do but bow to fate, and so the three remaining outlaws set off for the fair, while William took his seat in the headmaster's form room before a page of Latin verbs. But when the outlaws entered the fairground, it was as if William's absence had affected even the fair. There didn't seem to be any go in it at all. They mooched about for a few minutes without much enthusiasm. They wandered round to the waxwork tent, but it wasn't even open yet.
"I bet if we go round to the back and look under the tent, we could see it all," said Henry.
So they went round to the back, lay down on the grass, and cautiously raised the flap. Fortunately, the inside of the tent was empty of human beings, so they could feast their eyes on the dazzling array of historical figures that met their gaze. There was Henry VIII in red tights and a spangled cloak. There was Guy Fawkes wearing a black mask and holding a barrel of gunpowder. There was Mary Queen of Scots in a very elaborate anachronistic crinoline with an executioner who carried a real axe. And there were the little princes in the tower in black velvet suits and much befeathered hats. Ginger stared at the nearest little prince in the tower, open-mouthed and open-eyed. An idea had come to Ginger, an idea so daring that for a minute it took his breath away. Moments later, following Ginger's lead, the outlaws crawled under the flap of the tent and very, very cautiously approached one of the little princes. Very gently, they lifted the little prince and carried him away under the flap.
"He's about William's size, isn't he?" said Ginger.
They rolled him up in their overcoats and carried him through the hedge and along the road towards the school. They went round to the headmaster's form room, where William was sitting before a Latin grammar, upside down. They tapped at the window. With a wary glance at the small glass panel in the form room door, William came over to the window and opened it.
"What have you got there?" he said.
They unwrapped the little prince.
"Whatever!"
"It's Ginger's idea," said Douglas, with apprehension.
Ginger's idea was revealed to William. It was a plan after William's own heart. In a few minutes, the little prince, garbed now in William's school suit, was propped up at a desk in front of the Latin grammar, his elbows resting on the desk lid, his head on his hands. The outlaws climbed out of the window, and just as they slid it closed, they saw old Cramps, the caretaker, whom the headmaster had given the responsibility of checking on William, peering through the glass panel of the door and nodding to himself, reassured that the little devil was still there, sitting at his desk and learning his Latin verbs. William put Henry's overcoat on over the black velvet suit with lace collar and crushed the black velvet feathered cap into his pocket. The four outlaws returned to the fair.
"You can have a good look round," said Ginger, "and we'll be back by the end of the hour, and it'll be all right, and it looks just like you from the door." "We got in by a hole in the tent," said Henry. "They're jolly fine, the others. You'll like them. There's Guy Fawkes."
"I think William had better not go into the waxworks," said Douglas. "There'll be a fuss if they saw he was wearing their clothes. He can go round the stalls and go on the roundabout."
"Oh, can I?" said William.
"Oh, thanks, thanks awfully. Well, I've never seen a waxworks, and I'm jolly well going to go to the waxworks."
He stopped suddenly. His eyes gleamed.
"Tell you what," he said, "I'll go, and I'll be a waxwork. I'm wearing its clothes, so it seems silly not to have a try. I bet no one spots I'm not a real one." Douglas murmured disapprovingly, but Ginger and Henry were fired by William's enthusiasm.
"We'll come in and watch you. It'll be fun."
The inside of the tent was still empty of human beings. One little prince in the tower stood solitarily with an empty space beside him. From outside came the raucous voice of the showman informing the world that the show would open in 4 minutes only from now. As William took up his position and the outlaws retreated under the flap of the tent, a gaping crowd surged in the wake of a bored-looking youth. William stood there dramatically. His velvet hat threw a shadow over his face. The rope that kept the spectators from approaching too near was about 5 feet away from him.
"Little princess cruelly murdered in the tower," announced the bored-looking youth.
The group studied the little princes.
"Mummy, why do they have one pretty one and one ugly one?"
piped the youngest spectator.
"Well, perhaps they couldn't afford two pretty ones, dear, and they got this one cheap."
The group moved on to Mary, Queen of Scots. Another group approached, led by a negligent youth in plus fours. He took up his stand just in front of William and began to hold forth languidly.
"Of course, to anyone who knows anything about anatomy, these things are frightfully amusing. Look at that one, for instance."
He pointed languidly at William.
"It's quite absurd. Legs and arms entirely wrong. Out of proportion, set at wrong angles. Most amusing."
And he passed on to Henry VIII. William was already getting tired of being a waxwork. The lace collar tickled his neck, and the feather in his hat tickled his ear. He'd got pins and needles in his arm, and something was crawling up his leg. More than that, it was galling to anyone of William's proud spirit to have to listen meekly to personal abuse without retaliating. He breathed hard when two women stared at him for some minutes, and then one of them said,
"No wonder they murdered him if he looked like that."
And then Hubert Lane and his friends entered the tent. They glanced round at the other waxworks without much interest, but when they came to the little princes in the tower, their interest seemed to quicken.
"I say, look at that one," said Hubert, pointing at William. "Who does he remind you of?"
His companions began to giggle.
"William Brown. He looks like William Brown."
"Poor old William," said another. "Swatted Latin verbs instead of coming to the fair. It was a good joke, wasn't it, Hubert?"
They giggled together. Hubert leant forward over the rope and jeered at the little prince.
"Yah, silly old William Brown, who's got to stay swatting Latin verbs instead of going to the fair. Yah, yah."
It was more than William's proud spirit could stand. In a second, he'd leapt over the rope and was pursuing his amazed foes to the entrance of the tent and across the fairground. The spectators stood motionless. Then the youngest spectator pointed to Henry VIII and said,
"He's beginning to move too, Mummy. I saw him moving. They're all coming alive."
And they all suddenly made a rush for the doorway. The Hubert Laneites ran, panting and puffing, but unpursued, down the lane that led to Hubert's home, while William found himself in a public road wearing a humiliating costume. He ran by devious ways till he reached the old barn, where he knew instinctively the outlaws would be waiting for him. They looked at him gloomily. William looked coldly at Ginger.
"Can't think what made you think of a thing like this."
"It'd have been all right if you'd kept the overcoat on," retorted Ginger, "instead of messing the whole thing up pretending to be a waxwork."
William was too depressed to argue. Henry lent him his overcoat again, which restored something of his self-respect.
"The hour will be up now. I'm going back to get my own clothes. Come on."
They ran round to the window of the headmaster's form room, but they were too late. Old Markey was entering the door. The waxwork still sat as they'd left it, garbed in William's suit, propped up at the desk, its face hidden by its hands.
"Well, my boy," said Mr. Markson, "have you learned it?"
The boy continued to pore over the Latin grammar. Mr. Markson raised his voice.
I'll hear you now, my boy. You've had your hour."
Still, the figure didn't move. Mr. Markson went across and touched its shoulder. The figure collapsed onto the desk, head down, arms outstretched, as if abandoning itself to despair. Mr. Markson was evidently distressed at this.
"Oh, come, come, my boy, no need to despair. If you can say your verbs, no more will be said about the matter. Very childish to behave like this. Be a man, be a man."
The figure refused to be a man. Mr. Markson laid his hand again on its shoulder. It collapsed in a heap on the floor. Mr. Markson called loudly for the caretaker.
"Cramps! Cramps, bring some water. There's a boy here fainted."
Mr. Markson lifted the prostrate figure carefully in his arms, and then...
"What?"
The outlaws, of course, should have disappeared well before that, but horror, surprise, and fascination had deprived them of the power of movement. Mr. Markson looked around him, his eyes ablaze with lust for vengeance, and the first object it fell upon was William, standing outside the still-open window. The power of movement returned to William, but too late. The crisis was over. The outlaws assembled in the old barn to discuss the matter. They had taken back the waxwork to its proprietor, prepared for a scene almost as unpleasant as the one in which William and Mr. Markson had played the leading parts. But the proprietor was unexpectedly benign. The showman had doubled his expected takings. There was a rumour afloat to the effect that one of the waxworks was alive, and that you got £10 if you guessed which one it was. There was another that they all came miraculously to life every 20 minutes. A woman in very large spectacles and a dress of hand-woven tweed was saying that she could tell by the atmosphere that elementals were at work here, and that someone ought to send for the Psychical Research Society. The showman examined the figure, found it surprisingly uninjured, and dismissed the outlaws with, "You try it on again, my boys, and you'll hear something." They didn't feel like trying it on again, however. They'd already heard something.
"What I say about it is," said William, "that in spite of the cruel way people treat boys nowadays, I'd sooner live nowadays than then. I'd sooner be treated in the cruel way they treat boys nowadays than have to wear collars that tickle your neck and feathers that tickle your face all the time. Well, that's what I think anyway. And I ought to know. I've tried both."